song set in the bewildered rage.
Welcome to the What Now podcast featuring Allison Davis. In this episode, Allison talks with her friend Josephine about the trials and tribulations of battling multiple addictions. And now, Allison Davis.
So, Josephine, how have you been?
Oh, excellent, actually.
Yeah?
Thank you for asking. I've been very busy doing a lot of really fun things and in recovery. Thank God, you know.
Mm-hmm. I was thinking about the word addiction, you know, and it's essentially thrown around very casually these days. And, I mean, you know, I'll sit there and I'll say, well, I'm addicted to Angry Birds, you know, and other people will say they're addicted to their iPhones, etc. How would you define the word addiction in relation to your experience?
Well, what that makes me think of is a couple of ways that that I've heard in a couple of 12-step groups that I'm in. One is that addiction is the disease of more, M-O-R-E.
Yeah.
And another one is it's the phenomenon of craving.
Mm-hmm.
And it basically is the need to act out a compulsive behavior.
Mm-hmm.
Or you don't feel normal.
Right, right. What is that sensation when you are craving a substance?
You need it. Like you need air to breathe.
Mm-hmm.
Or like you're starving and you need something to eat. And of course, food is an addiction for me.
Right,
as
right.
Well.
And there's a lot of anxiety involved.
There is anxiety because until you get it, you're on pins and needles. You know, until you make that connection. A friend of mine who was a heroin addict
mm-hmm.
said that all of his stresses and worries and fears were wrapped up in just making that connection.
Right.
And once he made the connection, he felt great about his whole life.
Mm-hmm.
So the connection, the stress of the connection, making the connection for the drug, was the symbol for all of the other stuff that was really going on in his life that he wasn't paying attention to.
Right, right. And I gather also when you think about, you know, things in the abstract and not even the process of ingesting a substance. Maybe I'm going off on a little tangent here, but even the act of knowing when you are going to receive a substance or when someone is going to bring it to you or when you are going to be able to use, I mean, that creates a whole system of sensations as well as actually ingesting the substance.
Well, it does. It's a setup. You know, you're setting yourself up to fail with the whole thing.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you're betting your life basically that on the fact that you'll be able to get this substance which will allow you to keep going through the rest of the day and functioning. So you think, this is the illusion, that you need this to function and to be normal the way other people are.
Right.
In life, and to have the same kind of feelings, and to be able to function normally,
mm-hmm.
you know, and it's the expectation is like expecting hearing a rumor that Christmas is about to happen, and you don't know if that's real or not, but you heard the rumor that Christmas is going to happen. The next tomorrow, say. And so you get your hopes up and you're all excited, but at the same time you're scared that it might not happen. And
right.
if it doesn't happen, you feel like your life is threatened.
Right. I mean, this whole situation, this whole process is chemical. I mean, it's we're talking about brain chemistry here.
Yeah.
What? Oh, go ahead.
There's also a spiritual component. Well, I've known many people in recovery groups who are atheists,
mm-hmm.
really. So it's not contingent, recovery is not contingent on having a spiritual life or a belief in a higher power, but it certainly helps. And for most people, it's a major factor. And it is a question, it is a matter of connecting to something larger than yourself. A drug makes you feel a certain way. You're not making yourself feel that way naturally. Something bigger than you is making you feel a certain way, mm-hmm. you know? And connecting to something higher and bigger than you is a very important feature of recovery.
That can pull people out of depression as well.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
What were your particular drugs of choice?
Well, food.
Yeah.
Food's not a drug, really. I mean, we do need it to live. But the behavior of compulsive eating mm-hmm. Is what I'm addicted to. Mm-hmm. And I'm now in recovery for it.
But right.
That was my first drug of choice. Mm-hmm. Was, say, a chocolate cake. You know, that was my first drug of choice. I remember being 7 and not being able to stop eating a chocolate cake that my grandmother had made mm-hmm. and had put in the refrigerator for mm-hmm. dessert.
Right.
And I discovered it in the afternoon and had, like, half of it before dinner.
Right.
You know, I remember the whole feeling of not being able to get myself to stop eating it mm-hmm. and the kind of bliss out and that repetitive hand-to-mouth, the repetition that was so calming and kind of bliss out, really.
Yeah.
I remember that at 7,
right.
7 years old.
Wow. You're kind of in an altered state, it sounds like.
Oh, you are, definitely. It's kind of like being hypnotized.
Yeah, yeah.
It's like you're in hypnotic trance mm-hmm. doing this action, this behavior. After that, it was alcohol. And I do very much believe that that was a substitute because I was not acting out my the compulsive behavior relative to food. I had not been doing that, and I did not act out an eating disorder. Mm-hmm.
Were you dieting then?
I was. I was watching, I wasn't on an official diet, but I was always dieting. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's just something recently that I've come to be able to not do. I mean, to not have that...
Either or.
Yeah, in the back of your mind.
Yeah,
you know,
either you're restricting or binging. You're kind of growing away from that now.
Yes.
Yeah, that's very good.
Yeah.
And
it's new for me.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then when I couldn't, when I had given up going to a specific recovery group for alcohol, after I had a difficulty accepting how Christian the whole thing sounded.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't mean that to offend anyone who's Christian, because I totally respect a person being Christian and I respect their faith. But for me, it was a real turnoff. And I allowed that to get in the way of my recovery. And I fell off the wagon into prescription drugs at that point.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And that was definitely a replacement for the alcohol.
Right. And that was fairly recent. That was not too long ago. And you went to rehab for treatment.
Right.
If you don't mind my asking, what were the circumstances leading up to that experience?
Well, the prescription drug thing was getting out of hand. I was incredibly desperate. I was procuring the medication, or the supposed medication, in an illegal fashion. I was not going to a bad part of town and buying it off the street. But I'm not going to say how I was doing it because I don't want to give anyone any ideas. I was responding to scammers who basically just scammed money out of me with the promise of getting me some more prescription drugs. I happened upon a certain drug that is known as a muscle relaxant. It's not Quaaludes. I'm not talking about that. And I'm not going to say what it is either. That is a very bad drug, I think. and I began taking it to supposedly relax me, and I would fall asleep in the middle of eating dinner or something. It became unmanageable. It's the whole thing, you know, about the steps. If you know anything about the steps, your life becomes unmanageable. And my life was beginning to become unmanageable with prescription drugs.
12 steps. 12-step programs, you mean, by steps, right?
Yes, 12-step program. Yeah, sorry, 12-step mm-hmm. program. I was supposed to have a knee replacement operation, actually. And I had taken the drug night before to make sure that I could sleep, and I had taken it so effectively that I couldn't wake up, and so my sister and a friend had to call an ambulance to get me to the hospital to see if I would wake up for the operation. And I did wind up waking up, and I apparently sat, and I don't remember this, I sat up and I said, let's get a cab and go home. Meanwhile, I had been unconscious, and they didn't know what the hell was going on. I didn't apologize for anything. I wasn't upset about anything at all. It didn't occur to me that I had done anything wrong or untoward, mm-hmm. you know? And then as it occurred to me, in the aftermath of that, what was happening, I started coming to terms with the fact that I knew I was on my last binge, you know, it was the last straw. It was the last straw. And I wasn't going to be able to do that anymore. Mm-hmm. And I had made up my mind that I knew I was going to have to give it up and get back to recovery and all of that. Mm-hmm. And then I finally did make it to the operation. It was rescheduled. I made it to the operation. And I was in physical rehab after the operation. My sister had gone to my apartment to look for clothes, I think, to bring me, or to was looking for something of mine, and she happened across the stash of drugs. And that was enough of a shock to set the whole thing in motion.
Right.
For an intervention, for going to rehab for 28 days, which I did just like Sandra Bullock.
Yeah. How much time would you say went by between the finding of the drugs and your entering rehab?
The only time that went by was what was necessary for me physically, mm-hmm. medically, for my knee to recover mm-hmm. from the operation. It was maybe 10 days.
So you didn't experience any denial as far as...
Initially, I resisted it. Yeah,
you did initially.
I was willing to go to outpatient.
Yeah,
you know, but I did not want to go to away.
Right.
It wasn't the rehab that I didn't want to do. I didn't want to leave and go away and be away from my kiddies. That was my excuse. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, I was ready to go and do a program of some kind and to plunge back into recovery. That I was not resistant toward. Mm-hmm. I was accepting of the concept of recovery.
Right. You just didn't want to do it off your home turf.
Right. I didn't want to go to a strange place.
Yeah, that's understandable.
By myself and do it.
That's scary.
Yeah.
Yep.
But I did.
Yeah.
And I survived.
Yeah.
And they had really good food.
Oh, that's good.
Rich food. And so with my food addiction, I was getting away with murder.
Oh my goodness.
No.
Yeah.
You get three meals a day in rehab.
And
it was and I could smell the ocean. It was by the ocean. A place by the ocean was wonderful, and they had a meeting that you could go to on the beach early in the morning.
It sounds pretty cushy.
But yes, and it was a rehab where you could smoke cigarettes too.
Now that's interesting. Well, you can smoke cigarettes at AA also.
As far as I know, in very few meetings anymore.
Oh, really? You can't?
Really?
Oh, I didn't know that.
No. From what I've heard, I can't say specifically how I heard it
mm-hmm.
or if I have an involvement, but I've experienced the fact that they don't allow them in meetings anymore.
Oh, okay. Wow.
When I started in AA, they did. Mm-hmm. I mean, way back in the day, and in 1998, when I got sober in 1998, I was smoking like a fiend. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's another addiction of mine, is nicotine.
Yeah. I think...
smoking.
Which one do you
that
think...
30 oh. years.
Which substance do you think is the most pernicious substance? Which is the hardest one to kick?
For me, it's the eating compulsion.
Because you have to eat anyway.
Exactly.
Yeah.
The others, you can be abstinent and get a distance from it. And of course, I don't smoke now. I don't drink, and I don't take any anti-anxiety or pain medication. I just had oral surgery, and I refused pain medication afterwards. You can stay away from it, and as I said, be distanced from it. But from food, you're dealing with that all the time.
And it's condoned by the culture.
It's by the culture, and your entire childhood is full of food and right. dynamics, and your parents and your family and everything else in life, and your appearance for women, that's particularly a huge thing. Mm-hmm. Your self-image, your body image, mm-hmm. you know. That's the foundation one that I had just recently, it was last August, mm-hmm. that I finally came to terms with that.
Yeah, wow.
And came into full recovery with that.
Wow.
Which was way after the others, you know.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Which of the addictions would you say has caused you the most suffering?
I'd probably say if it's physical suffering and despair, and all, I would have to say alcohol.
Mm-hmm.
I would have to say alcohol because mm-hmm. I felt rotten. I was freaking out emotionally. I wound up having terrible hangovers. I felt like I was going down a drain. I physically felt so rotten.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I was lost emotionally, yeah, totally well. Lost emotionally. The prescription medication thing didn't get that quite that far.
Right. Well, as you know, alcohol is a depressant.
Right.
Yeah.
And I tend toward depression. Mm-hmm. So it was really genius of me to start drinking alcohol. What a genius move that was.
Do you think that engaging in addictive behavior is a form of self-medication? Self-medicating?
Absolutely,
yeah.
Absolutely it is.
Yeah.
And I know that a lot... I'm a bipolar person, and I know that I learned in an addiction study, actually, that a huge percentage of people who are bipolar have problems with addiction.
It's 85%.
85, really.
At least.
Yeah.
About the same number that will commit suicide or die if they are not medicated properly.
Right. Well, that's the level that you need. That's the level of desperation you have.
Yeah.
To medicate yourself.
Right.
When you're an addict or alcoholic.
Right, right. Do you think that addiction has a genetic basis?
I tend to think there is a physical basis. Mm-hmm. I tend to think that there is something genetic about it. Even though in my family, and my sister's done extensive genealogical research through ancestral lines and stuff, and the only person that we've been able to find who was a hard drinker, or perhaps, as you put it the other day, a high-functioning drunk, was a great, either uncle or grandfather, a great-grandfather, I think,
right.
on my father's side.
Mm-hmm.
And but there was no mention of it in the family.
Yeah.
Or anything good about it. All of my immediate family are completely people who can moderate. Even my father, who's also a Pisces like me, who loves a lot of good food and he loves his wine and he, you know, loves pleasure and all of that. He's a real epicure in many ways. Mm-hmm. Well, even Epicurus promoted moderation, but he can moderate when he has to, too. So there's been no one in my direct family who's had an addiction or alcoholism or a compulsive behavior
right.
that we can find.
Yeah, they also didn't.
Other than that one guy.
Yeah, they also didn't. You know, it was so stigmatized up until fairly recently. And I don't think back in the day people talked about it. So sometimes it's hard to know.
Yeah.
You know, and certainly...
Yeah.
Psychiatric diagnoses and or symptomatology, that wasn't even the same jargon in days gone by as it is is now. It's very, it's very different. Do you think there's a connection between creativity and addiction? It seems like a lot of artists, such as yourself, are prone to addiction. Why do you think this might be?
Yeah, I've been thinking about this, and I once read in a book on addiction, actually, something that this guy said. I don't remember what the guy's name is. It was an amazing book. He said that, and it totally rang true with me, that an artist, a true artist, is looking for transcendence, seeking transcendent experience, And I think that that's why a lot of artists tend to get mixed up in drugs and alcohol. You're looking for a transcendent experience.
Yeah, an out-of-body in a positive way experience.
Yes, right. It's like Steven Tyler said, he went to the right door, and he was trying to open the right door, but he was doing it with the wrong key.
Did you read his autobiography?
No, I haven't read the autobiography yet.
Yeah. Wow. Not to go back to more personal things here, how old were you when you began gravitating towards addictive substances? Well, you said 7 years old, you had that cake.
Yeah, 7 years old.
And, and then when did you start smoking and drinking?
I started smoking as a teenager. It was the 60s, and everyone smoked.
Oh, they did.
My parents would throw parties and they'd buy cartons of cigarettes and have them out for the guests, neither of my parents smoked at the time.
Mm-hmm.
My sister never smoked, but I smoked.
Mm-hmm.
And it started slowly, And by the time I was about 16, I was smoking a pack a day probably, 16, 17.
So when did you quit?
I quit in 2002.
Okay. Wow.
So I for a very long time. During the last years, since the 80s actually, I didn't smoke much. I mean, but apparently, even if you smoke a little bit, it's just as bad as if you smoke a lot. So smoking at all is a terrible thing. But I would have maybe 4 cigarettes a day or something like that, and which wasn't a whole pack. And I wasn't smoking a whole pack for a long time. Nevertheless, before going to sleep at night, I had to have those cigarettes.
Mm-hmm.
That was an addiction.
Wow.
And I would go out in the middle of the night and buy a pack of cigarettes if I had to.
Yeah.
To have those cigarettes before going to sleep.
Right.
And then I started drinking.
Mm-hmm.
I had had a drink here and there when I was a teenager. Totally above board. I mean, my mother made me a screwdriver once.
Mm-hmm.
And for some reason, in New York City, I went out to dinner with a boyfriend I had at the time, and we had some scotch, I think. And don't ask me how I got away with that, but we did. I didn't like it.
Mm-hmm.
I really actively didn't like it until I was 30, 1991. And then something switched. I don't know exactly what it was, but before that, I really did not like anything that was mood altering.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't like it, the feeling of it. That's why I never got into pot either.
Oh, God.
It would give me anxiety. Mm-hmm. I didn't like to be that removed from myself.
Right.
But when I reached 30, I was going through an emotional, a personal crisis. I lost a relationship, a career was failing. I went for absolute escapism and to feel good.
Mm-hmm.
I went to that as a self-medication. And because I am prone to compulsive behavior, it became an addiction. It became alcoholism.
Right.
Was mad. Yeah.
And so you were in the throes of alcoholism, essentially. How much time elapsed before you before you realized your life was, as they say, had become unmanageable and you decided to go into recovery meetings?
About 8 years.
And you're still doing them, right?
Yes.
Yeah. And
yes.
Do you feel it helped you?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
I think that I have discovered some stuff, which is kind of a little bit interesting. I've been to thousands of recovery meetings through the years. And I have since found, since basically I joined a specific recovery group focusing on compulsive eating last August, I've realized that what really ensures my recovery and gives me a security in recovery is adhering to the 12 steps that are in recovery groups. Meetings are great for fellowship and are very, very important to have a support network and people you can commiserate with and get inspiration from and have a connection with. But in terms of the hardcore recovery, that has been from a piece of literature that was a central feature in one of the oldest 12-step recovery traditions, the wisdom in that, and following what they say. I mean, you just do it, and you don't ask questions about it. You just follow it and do what they say and incorporate it in your daily life, and that equals recovery. But the meetings are tremendously helpful, and I even do some Skype meetings now.
Oh, that's great. I didn't even know they had them.
I have a sponsor in Australia.
Oh, my God. That's awesome. Maybe one day you'll be able to go and meet the person.
I know. That would be
That'd
so
be
great.
Really great. Now, you know, I know that a lot of people in recovery don't like to focus on, I know for people in who are trying to lose weight often are told in their groups, regardless of what the group is, to not focus on the number, to focus on the process, to take it a day at a time. You're a very slim person. May I ask you how much weight you've lost in this process this time?
Oh, in this process this time, I would say I was up to like 160 pounds, and now I'm at about 25, 30 pounds.
Good.
I lost. There was a time when I lost actually 40. I was up to almost 200 pounds, and I lost... I was 180 something pounds.
So you've cycled. You've cycled a lot. You've yo-yoed.
Absolutely. Up and up and down. Up and down. Yeah. And at that point, that was before 1998. My first major sobriety with alcohol. Because when I quit earlier than that, I don't count it as sobriety. Although I quit for 7 years, I count it only as being dry because I wasn't in recovery.
I see. There is a difference.
I went to meetings. I had gone to some meetings, but I had stopped going to meetings and was determined to do it on my own, which anyone in recovery will start laughing at. Because it's...
Yeah.
Go ahead.
No, it's the way one thinks, the way one deals with, navigates the world that has to be addressed in the recovery meetings. It's not just not doing the substance. It's about how to navigate the world and how to deal with other people and the way they relate to you.
Absolutely.
It's a whole...
An invaluable part of meetings.
It's huge. And, it's almost more important than the substance because the substance is kind of a symptom of all these other things that are going on that are negative.
That's exactly what it is. It's a symptom.
It is a symptom. So to focus on just drinking or not drinking or eating or not eating, you know, in and of itself won't permanently or at least consistently change behavior. You have to keep evolving upstairs.
For a long time, I've been like an all or nothing kind of person, and you know, that's a hallmark of addictive behavior.
It's also a bipolar trait.
There you go. There you go. There is a connection.
There's a black and white quality to things.
Yeah, an all or nothing thing, and it's just, you know, for years I did not have an eating disorder. And I was not on some draconian diet, you know, but I was in all or nothing mentality. And that I have come to realize so deeply is such a hallmark of addiction and alcoholism.
Oh, it is.
The extremes, you know.
And the food thing, too.
And yes, absolutely. And the food thing, because either you binge or you starve, just like you said.
Yep.
You know?
Yep.
And it's a merry-go-round.
It's horrible.
It's a
cycle. I was going to ask you, do you still experience cravings for any of these substances?
No.
Okay.
I can't say that. That's not entirely true. I do not for alcohol or the drugs.
Or cigarettes. But
not for cigarettes.
Right.
I mean, I have experienced a couple of times a craving for a cigarette, but nothing. I mean, it's been like more of a passing thought, and like the idea of like, oh, that would be a good idea, and then I go, not a good idea, and forget about it, you know. But with the food,
well, yeah, that's a constant sort of thing.
It's ongoing. It's something
It's a daily challenge. I think for compulsive overeaters, it's a daily challenge. I think for all eating disordered people, regardless of what the nature of their disorder is, it's a daily challenge. Whether it's anorexia or bulimia or compulsive overeating, it's a challenge.
It's incredibly difficult. Mm-hmm. And, you know, because you can't give it up. I mean, people do remain abstinent from, say, sugar or maybe chocolate or wheat or salty, buttery things. Or, you know, they have what they call trigger foods.
Exactly.
You know? But, you know, my sponsor has been what you would call abstinent for very, very many years. And she doesn't deny herself anything.
Yeah.
You know, she does not make a habit. You do not make a habit of indulging.
Right.
You know, because that's just playing with fire. But if you find yourself in a situation where you're hungry, for example, and the only thing there is to eat is something from a vending machine, and you're not going to be able to get to a place and you have low blood sugar or something, you know, you should be able to have a candy bar. You should be able to
have a not have it trigger you into a whole bender that doesn't end for days to weeks.
Exactly. Right.
What do you do on a daily basis to keep your sobriety?
Oh, I've incorporated what's known as the 12 steps. Into my daily functioning, my living and breathing every day. I notice, I become very aware of certain behaviors and certain tendencies. You become mindful.
Yeah.
Basically, it's the same thing as they say in Tibetan Buddhism, you know, you become mindful. You catch yourself thinking certain ways or behaving in certain ways. And there is an action and often a prayer that you can employ to discourage any
continuous thought.
Yeah, and any binge, or I was thinking in terms of food, but also, of course, to discourage having a drink or taking a pill.
That's cognitive behavioral therapy. That's CBT, cognitive behavioral therapy, what you're describing.
I had some of that. I was treated with some of that when I was in outpatient after rehab.
Yeah, it's very helpful for a lot of people.
Yeah.
You know, and the whole thing that you said earlier about the higher power of the 12-step groups, I think a really good way to put it for some people who just can't seem to grasp, you know, wrap their brain around the concept is that if you could continually take all responsibility, if one takes all this responsibility for one's personal failings in dealing with a substance of choice, you know, be it alcohol, drugs, food. Every time you slip and you smoke or you drink or you overeat, you're inclined to beat yourself up and flagellate yourself and then punish yourself by engaging in more of the same behavior, which will then continue the cycle of more self-flagellation, more self-hate, more abuse of the substance, and it just goes and it goes and it goes. So if you can give all this business over to a higher power, you can stop punishing yourself. And the punishment is the indulgence in the substance. Do you see what I'm saying? And if you can stop the punishing, you'll stop, you know, hurting yourself by, you know, engaging in the addiction. And then at that point, one can begin to heal.
Remorse is a dynamic of addiction.
Oh, yeah.
You know, and feeling you have to apologize over and over again for things. And, you know, remorse is a huge part of it. Absolutely. Mm-hmm. And if you can disengage from that, if you...
Remorse and guilt. I knew a therapist once who said that guilt was a completely useless emotion.
It is. Absolutely. I totally agree.
Yeah.
I know a guy who was a cocaine addict who, before he got into into recovery successfully and is now recovered for very many years. He would drink too, as an alcoholic. He would get so loaded and drunk. He once drove 5 freeways in a total blackout.
Holy
God.
This
was in Los Angeles. And the next day, it took him like 2 hours to get up the courage to go out and take a look at his car because he was sure he was going to see blood on the fender.
Oh, Christ.
You know? I mean, he was sure that he ran over someone and just didn't remember it.
Hmm.
You know, he would live through that over and over again, and I never experienced that, but I have experienced blackouts where I regret the behavior, where I have remorse, and that whole dynamic, mm-hmm. you know. Getting it over to your higher power is definitely the way to go. You are, again, letting someone else's will dictate your life in a healthy way.
Mm.
Not in the sense that you don't make any decisions for yourself. You do employ your self-will, making your living maintenance, life maintenance, and functioning decisions for yourself. But in terms of outcomes of things or getting incredibly stressed about how something's going to turn out or second-guessing conclusions or, you know, keeping yourself on edge like that, you turn it over to a higher power and say, well, it's up to you. You know, whatever you want, that's what's going to happen, and I have faith that that's going to be the right thing,
right?
Whatever it is. It yeah. takes such a huge load off your back.
Oh, yeah.
God.
I know, and then you can use that energy towards healing instead of,
yeah.
You know, fighting yourself.
And an addiction has components of control
oh,
in it.
Oh, God, of course
I mean,
it does.
You're trying to control your own moods. You're controlling artificially how you feel when you go up, when you come down,
mm-hmm.
what you do, and what you feel like. You know, it's a control issue as
mm-hmm.
well.
Mm-hmm.
And it's kind of ironic, too, because at the same time, I know particularly for alcoholics and drug addicts, going out of control when you're high or when you're a drunk is another dynamic of addiction, where you think you're controlling things by giving yourself a substance that will make you feel a predictable way, where you supposedly will be able to handle things. Subsequently, what happens is you go out of control
mm-hmm.
when you become drunk or high. And so it's weird. It's ironic. It's a conundrum.
Yeah, it absolutely is. Gosh. But however, does it get easier? Does sobriety get easier as time goes by? Whatever that means.
It gets more comfortable.
Yeah.
You know, I think that when you're first sober, it's not comfortable.
In what way?
Because, well, you're not used to dealing with the word world sober.
Yeah.
You're used to having a chemical or a crutch.
Rose-colored glasses.
You know, what?
Rose-colored glasses, perhaps?
Right. Yeah, sure. Something that affects you, that comes between you, yourself, and the world, that
mm-hmm.
pads it for you, kind of softens the experience, or else some people would say heightens it, but it's really dulling it.
Right.
It's not really heightening it,
yeah,
you know.
Sure.
You can feel really raw in the beginning, very nervous, very afraid. Sometimes it's hard to sleep. You just have to hang on. They just say hang on to your ass, you know, is what they say a lot. In early sobriety, it's well known that a lot of people just white knuckle it.
They what?
Before they latched on, white knuckle it.
Oh, yeah.
White knuckle it, just hold on, you know. I wouldn't say it's easier, but it's more comfortable.
Yeah.
What I said originally was the best way of putting it, I think.
Mm-hmm. That was a good
you
way.
Become more, you become more comfortable with it. I mean, the challenges are always there, and there's always something new that happens. There's always something different and unexpected that comes up, and you find yourself in a situation you haven't had experience with that's new, no matter how many years you've been sober or have been living through the process of becoming sober, like me,
mm-hmm.
you know. Since 1989, I've been living through becoming sober,
right.
The process of getting there, you know.
Mm-hmm. I think it's always, it's probably always a process, a different phase of the process.
It is. Absolutely it is.
Yeah.
Your whole life.
I think
absolutely.
It is. I think it is. What advice would you give to a family member who, or family rather, who has a member who is battling addiction? Like if you'd been your sister.
If it had been my sister, well, don't ignore it. Don't ignore it. Mm-hmm. I would say that. The person needs to be confronted, not as an enemy, but as someone on their side. Mm-hmm. Not in a negative confrontation, but bring it up for discussion. Number one, address it.
Exactly.
They're in trouble, and they need help, whether they know it or not.
Right, right.
And, but I would say, you don't approach them like telling them what to do,
mm-hmm.
because that will just get you an opposite reaction that it's more harmful to them, you know?
Right.
Don't start telling an alcoholic or a drug addict what they should be doing,
mm-hmm.
and that they should give up their substance and this and that and everything. You address the fact that they're in trouble, and it seems like they need help, and you really care about them, and so you would like to help if there's some way you could.
Exactly.
You know, you approach it like that. You don't approach it like a disciplinarian, or like they're being immoral and they need punishment
that
or something.
That would make them retreat.
That never works.
Yeah, that would make them retreat even more into their behavior.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Wow.
But you need to be real with them.
Mm-hmm.
You know.
Yeah.
And not just try to make light of it or ignore it.
Right. Exactly. Exactly. Well, you know, we're at the end of the interview at this point, so, Josephine, is there anything we haven't covered that you'd like to talk about or you'd like to add? I think it's been very enlightening. I think this could help a lot of people.
I really hope. You know, that's my only hope with it, really. I mean, that's what you do in meetings. You share experience, strength, and hope, and it helps a lot. Just to hear what other people have been through,
right.
You know, I've learned a lot from that. I do know, and it's important to know you're not alone and you're not crazy.
Right, right.
Well, maybe you're crazy when you're in your addiction, but if you're trying to recover, you're not crazy. You know, you're dealing with something very serious and life threatening, and something that needs to be taken very seriously,
mm-hmm.
and not put off. I would say. You know, it took me many years of dealing with this stuff to come to the point I'm at now. I do know a person who was an alcoholic. Okay, she came into recovery when she was 18, and she stayed there. And her life has been just brilliant. It's been wonderful. You know, and I wish that could have been me.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I wish I could have started in recovery when I started having an eating disorder when I was 18. And had addressed all of this stuff way back then,
mm-hmm.
because then I wouldn't have gotten to being 60 before I finally got a hold of the eating compulsion addiction, you know, which was the foundation addiction of all of them for me, you know, and also, as you said, it hasn't been so recent, the thing with prescription pills. That was 2009. I was 58
mm-hmm.
when I was in rehab.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and there were kids in there, and I would just tell them, you know, make it work for you this time. Don't wait anymore. It's not going to get better. It only gets worse. It only gets worse.
Do you think they listen to you?
No. I don't think so.
Well,
I mean, maybe a couple did, because they came up to me at different points and asked me stuff and talked to me, but as an addict or an alcoholic, it's very rarely that you listen to anyone.
You don't listen to yourself, even.
Oh, you don't. Exactly. You don't listen to anyone, in particular about your addiction. You know, and it's a well-known fact that alcoholics and addicts have a real problem with authority and rules and ways of doing things, prescribed ways of doing things. So the idea of taking on a 12-step program is anathema, you know. So, but you do it anyway, because it could be that one time that they do hear, that they do hear you when, in a meeting, if you say that, or if you address it saying, just do stick with the program, in your 20s or when you're 18 or when you come in, you know, don't let time slip by.
Yeah. That's excellent advice. Excellent. We only live once, and life is short.
Yeah. I mean, everything gets better in recovery. Without recovery, everything gets worse.
They say there are two kinds of alcoholics, essentially, and abstinent or dead.
Absolutely. That's really true.
In the final analysis.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. It's absolutely true. That's absolutely true. You know, there's a joke that I heard in a meeting one time. These two drunks are at a party, and everyone's going wild at the party, and the two drunks are very drunk, and everyone's dancing to music and partying, you know. And one of the drunks starts taking off his clothes and starts dancing and getting on tabletops and really having a rip-roaring time. And then he jumps down and he goes to his drunk friend and he says, "I can fly." And his friend looks at him and says, "Yeah?" And he says, "Yes, and I'll show you." And he goes over to the window and he jumps out the window. Well, his friend visits him in the hospital. He survives. And the drunk said, "Why did you let me do that? I was a lot more drunk than you." And his friend says, "Because I believed you." So it's just saying that his friend was so drunk also that he believed his friend when he said,
"He would fly.
I can fly." And didn't try to stop him. And that's the self-destructiveness of two drunks.
I'm sorry. I don't mean to even laugh.
Good. It is. It's supposed to be funny, too. Absolutely. I believed you.
It's tragic.
You could fly, sure.
It's tragic.
Yeah.
Wow.
But I heard an alcoholic say that in a meeting, at a recovery meeting. And everyone just fell out. Everyone just laughed as hell, like their heads off. He told it better, but...
I caught the drift.
Yeah, good.
Anna, this has nothing to do with anything we're talking about, but we've come to the end of the interview, so I'm going to ask you a joke, or tell you a joke.
Okay.
What's the difference between a woman in church and a woman in the bath?
I can feel it coming. I don't know.
The woman in church has hope in her soul.
Instead of soap in her...
So we can end the interview. That's how we'll end the interview. Up to the sky. And the stars come crashing. See the dream moon rise. And the wind swept lashing. Behind her. Human world outside her cage, she hears another bird sing a tap tap on the window. Come fly away with me, she says. How if I'm a prisoner of the only time I'm free is when I'm all dreaming. See the dream moon rise and the stars fall screaming. Behind her eyes she flies. She factory lights when cruel day breaks.
in a can.